Welcome to the Gritty Hour. Time to get down to the nitty-gritty.
Okay, so welcome to another episode of the Gritty Hour. We're here with my usual co-host, Sean E. Boy. How you doing, Sean?
What's up, team? I'm doing good. How are you, man?
All right. Today we have a very special guest, Joyce Heaton of J.E. Heaton Jewelers. She's a jeweler of note here in the Millbrook, New York area.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. She's been here for quite a few years, and the town has embraced her and her jewelry. And we're here to talk about some of her products and where she sells it and her online sales. And we're going to start by saying welcome.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here. This is a subject I always love to talk about.
Shawnee Boy or jewelry?
No, jewelry.
Oh, okay. So we're going to start. I'd like to know how you got into the business, because you certainly are very knowledgeable about the jewelry business.
Well, thank you for asking that question, because I think that's the key to, you know, what I've decided to do with this stage of my life. Mm-hmm. I think I've always loved jewelry, even as a little girl. I can remember gifts that were given to me. I don't know what it is that drew me to it, other than I think, actually, believe it or not, jewelry is sort of a crossroads for a couple of different things. One is there's art, because it takes skill and sense of design to create these pieces. I think it represents different cultures differently. I think it can tell different times in history. So, for example, I think for me, the best example of that is post-World War II, when there was such an incredible hope for the world and a looking forward to the future. And the jewelry that was produced was what we call retro, and it tends to be mixed metals. You have rose gold and yellow gold, and you have big stones, and you have bows and flounces, and there's an exuberance about it that just says a lot about the times. So for me, I think that's why I appreciate it so much, because I view it not just as something you wear, but what does it represent? I think that selling jewelry has been such a joy, and it is such a joy, because generally you're dealing with people for a very happy part of their lives. They're buying a nice gift. They're buying something to get, you know, committed to somebody.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing. So I grew up in a family where my mother and my two sisters and I all loved jewelry. So we were always, whenever we went shopping or somewhere, we would look for jewelry stores and we would look for things. And then I don't know when it happened, but eBay happened. And for some reason, I was home at the time raising my children. I was working out of the house, but I had a little bit of time and I discovered eBay, and I was able to find all sorts of things on eBay. And the best part about it was people would describe things. So I actually found I learned a lot. Now, I'm not sure that eBay is the same right now, but at the time, I spent a good amount of time learning. Mm-hmm. And I started buying, and then I started having to sell, like many people in the center, I think, are in the same boat, where they're collectors. And then you get to a point where, well, you have enough, so you have to sort of, you know.
Well, I always say an antique dealer is born when they first start walking sideways in their house.
Yes, I think that's true. That's true. So what ended up happening is I would go to a family thing and my sisters would say, oh, where'd you get that? Oh, well, I'd like that. And they'd try it on, they'd take it, and they'd buy it from me. Mm. And this went on for a period of time, and I wasn't quite sure how I would embrace selling jewelry. I didn't know what form, and my children were teenagers, so I wasn't quite ready to do anything major. But eventually it became apparent to me that, you know, I wanted to do this because I wanted to, share my love. I wanted to, share my appreciation of the artwork of jewelry. and I had a lot of pieces, so I needed to get rid of some. So that's kind of how I started.
So then, is that when you first started, like, I guess, scouting out property and numbers?
Well, actually, no. What happened was it was kind of a perfect storm for me because I was fortunate enough to buy a property on Franklin Avenue. It was the least expensive property on Franklin Avenue in Millbrook. And I wanted to do that as an investment, which I did. And I rented it out for a period of time. And then eventually the renter was not going to renew the lease. And I wasn't sure there were many people in the pipeline at that particular point. I think it was somewhere around the housing crisis, fiscal crisis we had, 2008? Yeah. So, I was encouraged by my family, maybe now's the time. And I always wanted to have a store. I mean, it's just, I think that's something that you either have or you don't have. You know, I come from a family where one grandfather had a hardware store in Poughkeepsie called Van Benskoten's. And my other grandfather was involved in a florist, and my uncle had an insurance. You know, there was just always a sense of having a small business. Mm-hmm. And I think that was sort of ingrained in me. And even as a kid, you know, I was the one who wanted to, do the lemonade stand. I wanted to play store all the time. It just always was something that interests me. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why. I like people. It's a challenge, but it's an opportunity to be creative. You create.
So around that time, that's when J.E. Heaton Jewelers was born.
So I had this property. It wasn't going to be, I didn't think I could rent it. I had been thinking about moving into the world of a jewelry retail. Meanwhile, up in Kingston, New York, there was a jewelry store that was going out of business. There was a dynamic salesperson named Ann Barton and an incredible jeweler named Glenn Stingel, both of whom were not going to have a job after the store closed. So I was sitting there. My children are gone. They're in college.
Well, how many years were you in that store?
I was in that store for 6 to 7 years.
Okay.
So I was at a point where all of a sudden my children are gone. I have the inventory that I want to move. I want to do the retail business. Anne and Glenn are available. And my tenant, it looks like I'm going to have a space. And I just thought, if something isn't telling me I should do this and do it now, I don't know when I'm going to get that hint. Uh-huh. So I, talked it over and gave it some thought. And I decided to go ahead and proceed and open the store. And it's interesting once you make that decision. I mean, I had a really clear vision of what I wanted everything to look like. And it was, I think, a beautiful little shop, and it worked out well. And then, life changed a little bit. My husband had to retire. We, moved up to Maine. And
you sold the building.
Kept
the business online.
I did. I kept the business online.
A thought just crossed my mind.
Sure.
He must have really had to impress you when he proposed to you.
No,
with that ring.
No, he did not, which is why I got involved with my own jewelry.
Joyce, when you switched from, because you said when you moved to Maine, you had to go online. Did you find online, obviously it's a different animal. Did you find it as lucrative, or was it a different kind of challenge?
It's a different kind of challenge. I think maybe if I was younger and I understood it better and I understood how to make it work better. But I also think jewelry is very difficult because you're spending a lot of money on something. And, to buy it online without seeing it or touching it or feeling it or looking at it, I think it's really hard. So I think those two factors, my inexperience, I think probably because of my age and the fact that people are a little reluctant to buy online. I was glad because when I got to Maine, I redid my website and I'm able to sell online now. I felt like I needed to try that. But I still really missed it in terms of personal fulfillment. I really wanted to be around people again. And so we made the decision we would split time between Maine and New York. And the first place I came was to Tom. And I said, Tom, I'd love to be able to do a store within a store here in Millbrook in your place. But I need to be in the front because of security. And I need to, I need to be there because of security. And he accommodated all of that. And it's been interesting because when I had the store up the street, people would come looking for jewelry, but they would walk by because they didn't think they wanted jewelry. What I found in the antique center is people come in for a variety of things that they're looking for. And it's increased my customer base because they find me. They're not looking for me. They're not looking for jewelry, but they find me. So that's a wonderful thing.
They come in looking for a wine basket and they leave with a necklace.
Yeah, that's kind of what I hope.
I have the same experience. I've been through that store and I'm just kidding.
You're a future customer, Sean.
I could be. So would you find that in your business, people aren't looking for it, but when they come across and they see it, they stop, they look before you know they're buying a ring or they're buying earrings or, wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, that happens. And then of course there are people like me who are, you know, they hone right in on jewelry. The other thing that I wanted to do is I wanted to do consignment, and consignment is a really labor intensive process. So I have to take in items. I have to detail description, weigh and measure stones and determine if they're gold or silver, what they are, write up spreadsheets, negotiate with the customers. I do research online to find out pricing. So it's a bit of work, but not a lot of jewelers do it because it is a bit of work, but I don't mind doing it. In fact, I like it because it brings in things to my store that I wouldn't necessarily pick out, or I might not be able to afford to have an inventory, but I have them there on consignment. And then once they sell, that the consignor gets paid. And that's worked out really, really well for me. I have also, I also do an awful lot of custom work now too. So people will come in and say, oh, well, I've got my mother's ring, but I really don't like the setting and I'd like to do something different. I'm thinking about making a necklace for my daughter. And, you know, oftentimes that will result in a custom job and, you know, we come up with a design and I utilize Glenn, who's also now independently located at the Millbrook Antique Center, but he's a jeweler who is available to me. So that's worked out very well too. So I'm very happy with all of that.
Sounds like you really have your finger on the pulse of your business, of like that world.
I hope so. I still find that the website, even though I don't do a lot of selling of the website is a good thing because I have my customers will come in and say, I saw this on your website. I also just recently, probably almost a year ago, started doing social media. I have someone who does Instagram posts, and if I see something interesting, I'll send it to her, and sometimes she'll find something. And that's been really fun. You know, so I am still trying that world, the world of the internet or social media. But I would say primarily my love is dealing with people one-on-one. And the other thing that was important to me, because I felt like you'd walk into a jewelry store and it was sort of like you felt like you couldn't touch anything and everything was, you know, quite a bit of money and nothing was priced. So you had to talk to a salesperson and they had to give you the whole spiel. My approach was one of transparency. So, for example, I put prices on everything I put in my case. So you don't have to get my spiel. You can look and see and know, feel comfortable with whatever price range, you know, because you see it right there. I do a lot of research to substantiate, as I said, pricing. And I share that with my customers because, once again, I think that the biggest thing in jewelry is that they know who I am and how I operate. And I try to be as forthcoming and as honest as I can be. And I think that creates an environment where you have people that come back. And I've been fortunate in that way. I really have been. And I can attest,
Shoni Boy, that a lot of her clients that went, you know, got to know her when she had her shop up the block, have remained loyal to her. She gets a lot of that same clientele.
I think,
and I'll also interject that it's a win-win for the store itself too, because you bring a lot of traffic that wouldn't normally come in. So it's not only just people that are coming in to shop for antiques and looking at jewelry. There's a lot of people that came in specifically for you that end up buying antiques.
Yeah, well, that's so it's a win-win. I'm glad you
and
feel that way.
And I was a little distracted before because I was looking. I want to tell people who are watching and listening that we're trying a new setup here where we're doing everything over Zoom. Shawnee boy's going back to work soon, so he can't be live in the house.
Watch your mouth.
He's going back to teaching the youngins. So, but now I'm distracted by how much I look like the guy in the Gritty Hour drawing, which is right between Joyce and I.
Yeah.
It's the glasses, I know, and the hair. And
This is the oldest you've ever been.
Well, yeah, it's the youngest I'll ever be. But anyway, I also wanted to interject. She's also loyal to her people, too, because she mentioned Glenn Stengel, who is a jewel repair man. She brought him with her into the shop here when she came back to Millbrook from Maine. So she remained loyal to Glenn as well. That should be.
Yeah, and he's a wonderful craftsman for anybody that needs. You know, he worked actually for a very famous jewelry designer named David Uhrman back in the day. He's old school. He uses a torch, but he's really exacting. So he's a good jeweler. Sean, I brought a couple of things. I just wanted to talk a little bit about what interests me about a few pieces that I have here.
Yeah.
Well, Would you like me to share that?
Before you get into that, I was just going to ask you,
What happens
when you say you take consignment and you do mainly estate jewelry?
I do. You know what? It's not just old jewelry. It's some of it is new jewelry. It really doesn't matter.
So if somebody who happens to be listening or watching has some, like a great grandmother's whatever, what would be the best venue, especially if they're not from the Millbrook area, to reach out to you on your website?
Yeah, I actually have it. I explain the process on my website, uh-huh. And it's, you know, possible to.
And that's jeheatonjewelers.com.
That's correct.
And we'll put a link to that below the video and the audio, depending upon where you're consuming this.
Before you guys go any further, for someone like me, or I know there's listeners who may not know what consignment really means.
Consignment means I don't, if you bring something in, I don't pay you for it. Mm-hmm. What I do is I take it in and you trust me to have it within my store and that I will sell it for you. And at the time I sell it for you, you will get paid. I usually pay people within the month. So, okay. But you know, it's a little scary for people to leave things and especially jewelry, and hope that someone's going to sell it.
Yeah.
But there's not a lot of other venues. I mean, they could do eBay, but you have to really feel comfortable with that or one of the other websites. But
well, what makes you comfortable with it as opposed to having everything you sell be proprietary to you?
I like
a better selection.
Well, first of all, to be honest with you, I don't have to outlay a whole bunch of money for inventory, right? Because I get inventory. A lot of my inventory is consigned to me. And also some of it isn't that old. Some people just say, you know, I've had this ring in here for 2 years and I haven't worn it. Let's just
get rid of it. The divorce is final. Here's the ring.
That happens too. And I just want everybody to know that we steam the heck out of those rings. We get rid of all those bad memories. They're gone.
Little exorcism.
Yeah. Little exorcism. So the issue with the consignment is, you know, you hear nightmares of people who, you know, they never get paid for something or it never gets processed or whatever. So I try to really be on top of the process, and it's a lot of paperwork. And that's what I do when I'm not here in the store.
I'm sure it has to pass a certain muster.
I can't take everything. There are things that I look at and I realize the stone is chipped or, you know, it needs repair or it isn't what it says, you know, you think it is. So.
Yeah, well, you can also sell more expeditiously if you only take in the higher quality stuff.
Right, yeah. Right. But I also like having a wide range of things because I like having a price point for everybody. Because mm-hmm. I feel regardless of what your budget is, you should be able to find something interesting and nice, you know, that you can give or keep. And I regardless of, you know, regardless of what it is. So I have a lot of silver.
So you have a wide range.
I absolutely do. I absolutely do.
Is that also now just mechanically, everything that you have in the shop is not online, right?
Everything except for silver, because I have been buying some silver outright just because it's a really lower price point. Mm-hmm. But everything else, you know, there's a lot online.
So especially gold, no matter what the carat, but if you put it into the store, it's online.
It's
as well.
Online. Yep.
So you
yep.
have to, yep. you have to maintain yep. both. Yeah. Okay.
I absolutely do. And it's a long process to do that, because by the time I get, you know, the agreement to consign it, then it has to be cleaned and inventoried and right. photographed and tagged. And, you know,
out of curiosity, if someone sees a ring online.
Yep.
And they, you know, it's a size 8 and their finger is a size 7. I don't know what the size is. Ask Sean how I make up stuff with golf.
yeah. No, actually, I think 6 is the standard size of a ring.
Very good. Yeah. That's, I think the average
size. I totally just guessed right there.
the average size for an American woman is actually 6.5.
Wow. All right. All right.
So you're close.
Say there's a woman who's size 7 and you have a 6.5 size ring right. online. That can be adjusted if they're from Missouri somewhere. That can be adjusted by Glenn, correct?
Well, actually, no. I choose not to do that.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because sizing a ring actually can be trickier than you think, because people's rings, fingers swell in the summertime. They get thinner in the wintertime. People who take medicine sometimes have issues with
right.
so. You know, you really have to be careful. So I would prefer, if you're not from around here, that you go to your local jeweler and have them do it. Because
so you would they would purchase the ring from you.
Yes.
You would ship it to them or to their jeweler?
I would ship it to them.
Whomever they want.
Whomever they want.
And then they would do the sizing over there.
Right.
Okay.
Because that just makes sense. Because otherwise it could be not exactly right and comes back and forth. And it's really better. It's really, it's like getting a really good pair of shoes and getting the right fit.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
But I know I've seen you, people from the New York area that come in and you get they come from a wide swath around.
Yes,
here.
They do.
They'll pick out a ring. It'll not quite fit in your jewelry.
And then I send them upstairs.
To Glenn.
And Glenn will do that independently. Which is great. It's super convenient having him here. So that works out well.
Sean, is our operation at the Millbrook Antique Center starting to impress you?
I mean, I'm just taking it all in, T. I'm digesting. Just, I had a question.
Later to the second floor.
what's your go-to trick if a ring gets stuck on somebody?
If a ring gets stuck, it's simple. Windex.
We'll cut the finger off.
Windex.
Okay.
So you spray the finger with Windex. And here's the other important thing when you have a hard time getting a ring off, is you have to remember to relax your fingers. Because when you do them straight, it actually adds some muscle to your knuckle.
So you want to keep it like kind of like this?
Yeah. So you want it. You want you spray Windex. You want your hand relaxed. And then I'd like to say you walk it over your knuckle.
Okay.
That's the trick.
I don't wear any jewelry, but I did when I was about 20. I'm my ears pierced and et cetera, whatever. But so.
Well, just, you know, you might have a moment where you decide to go back to those days. And,
well, if I do, I'm coming to you for sure.
I'm here and waiting, Sean.
I'll interject now that Joyce does have a pretty extensive selection of well-known designers jewelry in the shop, and I think she brought a couple of pieces here.
Yeah, I brought a couple of designer pieces and a couple of pieces I think are sort of interesting.
Anybody listening to us on Google or Spotify or Apple, just use your mind's eye for the next few minutes. She's going to hold up some pieces of in case you're listening to us in those venues. We also have a YouTube channel, which is where you'll be able to see these pieces.
So the first things I'm going to hold up are two rather large bangles, both of which are enamel over a lightweight wood. They have a lot of bulk. One is black, one is red. They're very shiny, and they're definitely statement pieces. And the other thing I'm going to show
is there a designer behind that?
Well, I'm going to show another piece before I do that, but that's okay. I'm going to show a cross that is has a little bit of a teardrop shape on the bottom. And actually, right up there?
Yeah, that's perfect. Okay. Yeah, right there. That's good.
Okay. And these three pieces are by Elsa Peretti, who was a famous designer who worked for Tiffany, and she passed away several months ago.
Oh.
I would say that the bangles are very 1980s. And Sean picked that up when we were talking earlier. And the cross actually with this sort of teardrop shape at the very bottom is very typical of her work. For me, what's interesting is, you know, I just recently watched the documentary on Studio 54, and then I watched the Halston documentary, and then there was something else on Halston. The 80s become so very popular right now, and really, when you look at Halston, when he made perfume towards the end of his career and he developed this bottle, what they talk about in the documentary is, you know, nobody wanted to make that bottle because it was such an unusual shape and it was going to be difficult to make and nobody had ever done anything like that before. And he persisted. And it really very much reminds me of an Elsa Peretti design. And they were very, very good friends. But it's her work is very classic, but yet very modern. And it's very collectible. And like artwork since her passing, I think it has become even more popular. But I also think what's added to that is the interest in the 1980s. And she was a key figure in design in the 1980s. So I have those. And I have a couple of older pieces. I have three rings that I just wanted to show you. All three of these rings contain sapphires. The one here is a beautiful blue sapphire. Now, what people don't know about sapphires is that they come in every color, blue being the most popular, I would say followed by pink. This is more of a royal blue, which is a preferred color with a sapphire. The one in the center is an Art Deco ring, which has sapphire accents. Those very likely may not be real sapphires. They figured out a way to make imitation stones in a very nice way, and they weren't inexpensive. And the smaller a stone is, the more washed out it looks. So they were able to make these smaller stones with very intense blue color. And it's, you know, it's gorgeous. They used them in diamond rings and platinum and, you know, very expensive jewelry. This could be American. And actually, that's what we call a knuckle ring because it has a center lozenge, but when you put it on your finger, it almost goes from the base of your finger up to your knuckle. It has diamonds in the center. The one over here is a lighter blue, and that's what we would call a Ceylon sapphire. Well, it comes from what is now Sri Lanka. And it's also in the Victorian era, they used lighter blue sapphires, and they called them cornflower blue. But it's people are very, you know, interested in that color as well, because it's just a very pretty sort of light blue. So there are three rings with different ages. I would say this one might be 80s to 90s. The one in the center, the knuckle ring, is probably 20s, 30s, maybe into the 40s. And the one over here is probably 90s, more recent. So you have three different examples of sapphire rings. They're all here on consignment. It's a nice little array of color.
Shawnee boy, jeheatonjewelers.com. You can own all three before you put head to pillow.
Now, you said the one was from the 1920s and 30s. Does that one have more value because it's older, or it doesn't work that way?
It depends. You know, some people gravitate towards modern design and some people like the Art Deco. I consider myself a collector, and I happen to really love the Art Deco style. I love how they took the metal and made it look like lace. And actually, you know, in the Edwardian time, they did wear a lot of lace, and the Art Deco is, you know, follows that time frame. So it might be an example where jewelry style follows fashion. Because to me, there's an intricacy. And I also think that, you know, when you talk about the early 1900s, 1920s, 30s, 40s, I mean, you had a lot of fine, fine craftsmen from Russia and Germany and who came to this country, went to Newark, New Jersey, or New York City, at Providence, Rhode Island, and really shared their heritage of craftsmanship. And I think made a big difference with the quality of American jewelry.
Is that like the three main places? I'm curious why you said those.
Well,
three.
I think about like Oscar Heyman in New York City. They did a lot of fine work for many jewelers as well as their own work. Mm-hmm. And it was four brothers that came from Russia. And, you know, they had worked for Fabergé. One of them had worked for Fabergé in Russia. So, you know, but they were Jewish, and I think they had to leave the country, and they came to the United States because we did what we try to always do, which is welcome others from other countries who are in danger into our shores. Mm-hmm. And then Germany, you know, Germany had all sorts of problems before World War I, and then problems during World War I and World War II, and people had to leave their homeland and come to this country. So I would say, and
they brought their talent.
They brought their talent with them.
And yeah, you mentioned Fabergé. That's the Fabergé eggs, right?
Yes. Yeah.
That was I know that from the Ocean 11 trilogy movies. They did like a thing on that.
Oh, really? I'll have to watch that. I didn't know that.
Ocean's 12 is it's about like heisting, you know, heisting movies. But Ocean's 12, the second one, is about the Fabergé eggs, and they try to steal them and all that.
Yeah.
George Clooney in them.
Yep, George Clooney, Brad Pitt, all that.
I probably would like that.
I thought it was a remake of the Rat Pack.
Oh, yeah.
I think it was, actually.
Well, the Ocean's 11 was a remake of the old Ocean's 11, but then they capitalized and made two extra ones.
So here's another Art Deco piece.
The green light is the camera. So.
Oh, okay, the green light is the camera. And this is a lovely platinum bracelet that has, once again, like the knuckle ring, very beautiful metalwork, in my opinion. And it's accented by older cut diamonds as well as little emerald stones. And similar to the sapphires in the ring, they're probably not real emeralds, but they certainly, you know, anytime you take a colored stone and you put a diamond next to it or vice versa, it really just pops the color.
Yeah.
So that's a lovely piece.
Oh, I'll ask you. I meant to ask you during when you were showing the rings as well.
Sure.
What is the base metal? Is that sterling silver rings? Or
no, the rings are gold, white gold, and the knuckle ring in the center is actually platinum.
I see. So what would be, you know, the carats of the ones that are gold?
Yeah, they're 14 okay. carat. Yeah. And what's interesting about white gold is that, you know, gold is normally yellow.
Right.
And they didn't really figure out how to make it white until like the 1910s, 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
Also, very early Georgian jewelry is often silver, just all silver or silver on a gold base, because working with platinum is very difficult. And platinum, they really didn't, my understanding is, figure out how to work with platinum until the building of the Suez Canal, when they were forced to figure out a way to make a small torch of such intensity that it enabled them to finish the canal. And they found that actually worked well on platinum. So the whole idea about the white metal is that if you went somewhere and you had gas light or you had candlelight, that the silver metal sort of reflected the diamonds much, much nicer, in a much nicer way. So then when they figured out how to use platinum, we see all of this beautiful platinum jewelry starting in the 1910s, 1920s.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't know that about the torches.
Yeah.
So that last piece, which the bracelet you just showed, that's also white gold?
No, that is platinum.
Okay.
And platinum. Oh, I'll have to take it off again. Hold on one moment.
Is platinum more in value than gold, generally speaking, or?
Well, you know, metals are a commodity, like oil, and prices go up and down and up and down. Yeah.
based on demand.
Back, you know, 20 years ago, actually over 30 years ago, when I was getting engaged, platinum was quite a bit more expensive than gold. Gold has now gone up quite a bit. Platinum is still a little trickier to work with. So you do tend to see more white gold than platinum in newer pieces. The other thing that's going on with white gold now that customers should know about is most white gold is now coated with rhodium. It's rhodium plated. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One is that it preserves the whiteness of the piece because that sometimes that yellow gold over time fights to come out. So if you see an old 14 karat white gold piece, it might look have a little bit of a tinge to it. And all it really needs is to be replated in rhodium and it would just pop. And rhodium, it's not like a cheap thing. Rhodium is actually in the platinum family. It's, I think, a derivative of platinum.
So it doesn't hurt its value.
No. And then what's also happening is we're now rhodium plating silver. So, for example, the silver chains that I choose to sell are rhodium plated. And the beauty of that is they don't need to be polished. You know, the big drawback with silver is you have to polish it. And if it's a piece that has stones, you have to be careful because, you know, you don't want the chemicals of the polish to affect the stone. So rhodium plating is very accepted within the industry now.
I just wanted to ask about the, like gold. Most jewelers use the London Gold Exchange as the Bible as to what the value of the gold is at the time.
Actually, I go online. I that might be the basis. I don't know that for a fact.
Okay.
But I use something called Kitco, KITCO.com. And they will give you the prices during the day, intraday. You can get the prices of gold. And you can actually, I believe, go in and put in a date maybe 10, 15 years ago, and it will show you what the value was there.
Interesting. Well, yeah. I'm just curious. I know, I'm fairly certain the London Exchange is the
determining factor.
They're the ones that do the regulation, but the determination of the day, each day's value of gold.
Right, right. So
what I was going to ask really was, is there something uniform like that for platinum?
Yeah, I believe Kitco does the same thing. I think all metals you can do it.
Is there a commodity exchange that handles platinum?
You know, I believe that there is, but I don't know. I don't understand. You know, I should find out more about that end of the business because I don't know exactly how it works. I do know that, you know, I can track the price of platinum on a daily basis and I can track the price of gold on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And what's happened with gold is, you know, I was buying things, you know, as I said, back in the day when eBay started, and gold was $200-$300 an ounce, and now it's $1,800 an ounce.
Oh, wow.
That affects me because, you know, when I do custom work, I have to buy, you know, a bale, which is the thing that the chain goes through in a necklace, or I have to buy, you know, a setting, or I have to do something, and those things are now quite expensive.
Well,
do you
adjust your prices accordingly based on the fluctuation in the underlying market of gold?
I don't, but what happens is when I buy things from my suppliers, they make that adjustment. So I get whatever they choose to charge, and I'm sure that includes the daily price of
gold. But something you may have bought, like just as an example, say gold was $2,500 yesterday,
right?
And you buy a piece. Say you buy a piece, and then it goes up $500. The underlying value of gold.
Right.
Do you then adjust your item up? Or?
Well, you know, in some cases, maybe I don't do that automatically. And the other thing that I look at is I look at the overall appeal of the piece. So sometimes someone will bring something in for consignment and it's very heavy gold, but it's something that based on my experience, I know it's really not going to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And that probably the consigner would get more money if they scrap it than if they consign it. So it, that kind of thing does come into play in
right.
my decision process,
right?
But I don't like go through my case and update everything
right.
when the prices. And it's been fairly, there was a was last year, the year before, it was going up, you know, I think it went up from 15 or 16 up to 18. And then it was sort of like, oh, well, wait a minute here. But it's been fairly much, you know, it's gone under and above. The other thing that's, I think, interesting about gold is that now people, you know, gold was always a hedge for inflation. And now people are using Bitcoin and those derivatives as a so that's going to affect gold, and that's going to affect, you know, what I buy from my suppliers. So it's interesting.
Well, it used to be gold used to be the antithesis to the market. The market, stock market went up,
gold went down.
Stock market went down, gold went up, because people would dump their money, take it out of stocks, put it in gold.
Right.
Now they're putting it in other commodities, if you want to call Bitcoin a commodity. They put it in other commodities beyond gold or in addition to gold.
But those things do factor into what I do, because it is part of an analysis I have to do when I take something in, and it affects custom work I do because of what I have to purchase from my supplier to get a job done.
Well, now you got me curious, and I don't want to go off on a tangent, but you got me curious as the price of gold today. How much would it be if there was no such thing as Bitcoin or other?
I don't know. I mean, I think that's a fair question.
Yeah, but I don't want to.
No. And also when there's when there's instability in the world, which affects the stock market, it affects the gold market. So, I mean, it's interesting.
But just wondering how much of percentage wise, how much of the value of gold is
part of what I sell?
Well, lower if gold is lower than it should be because of the value of Bitcoin or other, other places, other safe havens, so to speak.
Yeah, and it's kind of held its own at around the 1800 level for a long, you know, for quite a while now. So I don't, it maybe would have gone further up, but it's being held in check maybe by Bitcoin.
So I've also noticed, because these were rules of thumb when I was in the, you know, involved in the stock exchange.
Right.
I was a broker on Wall Street. One of the rules of thumbs, as I said, was gold was a safe haven when the market went down. It would go up in value when the market went down, down in value when the market went up. But I noticed, because back then also silver would rise and fall, not at the same level, but almost the same rate of up and down that gold did go up and down. And I've noticed that's been separated now.
Yes.
Like sterling. I know it's up like $3-4 over the last few years, but
it's like $27 an ounce versus 18.
But it was a few years ago, it was somewhere between 13 and 16.
Right.
So it has gone up, but not as rate wise, not as high as gold has.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Just curious.
The other thing that people do for investment is people do buy stones and, you know, hold on to them for a while and then sell them, because right now colored stones have become quite popular.
Like what kind?
Well, sapphires are, and a lot of this now is, it, you know, being gauged by or being caused by, like what I'm hearing is people say, well, China, people in China are very interested in sapphires. And so they've created a market that is much more competitive. But the other thing about stones that is an issue, I think, especially with very socially conscious younger people, is the mining process for a lot of these. And there's been a lot of attention within the jewelry field about, you know,
diamond mining
and colored stone mining. And there's a lot going on now with that. And there's a lot of consciousness now about that. But that's another reason why I kind of like doing consignment, because you're not necessarily mining a new stone. You're taking something that already exists and selling it. So it kind of, in my mind, sort of takes the mining issue a little bit out of the equation.
Off the table. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. Well, I do see some other nice pieces.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a few things. I just wanted to show you, I think this is a really interesting, fabulous piece. I'm going to hold it up. It's something that came in. It's actually gold.
That's my great grandmother.
It's about a quarter of an inch wide, as you can see there. But it's just beautiful. It's a little enameled piece that was all hand painted. And this is what I'm talking about.
Can you take it out of the box?
Sure. Yeah. This is what I'm talking about when I say, you know, I love the art of this, because, you know, this is really, really, really intricate work.
It looks like it's from like the 15, 1600s.
Exactly. I was going to say Elizabethan, which.
Yeah.
Is that, do you know?
It's all, you know, you can tell by the way that gold is sort of wavy, and I mean, this is not a standard size. So this all had to have been hand done.
Do you know how old that is approximately?
I don't know. I mean, usually this type of thing you would date by the dress and the hairstyle.
And that was all hand done?
Yeah, it was all hand done.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it is.
How would someone wear that?
Well, you can wear it as a pendant because it has a bail at the top. Mm-hmm. And it also has a pin stem in the back. So you could wear it as a pin. Because it has this width, oftentimes something like this might have been like a memorial piece, like a mourning jewelry. And there might have been space in the back for lockets of hair or something like that.
But does it open?
This does not. Okay. So this has probably been modified over the years. But if we're judging this based on the picture, it looks quite old. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Sometimes there are reproductions that I've seen, but I can kind of tell the reproductions because they look almost a little cartoon-like. This is definitely not a reproduction.
Hold it up one more time.
Because it's very finely painted.
Mm-hmm. Sean, how much money you got on you? Look under your pillow behind you.
I don't know. I don't know. I know. I'm also looking at, like, imagine wearing that outfit. The amount of work, just...
Took them days to get dressed, Sean.
Hey, I'm looking, I'm like, why would you want to wear that? But that was the time.
You didn't come to the party. I couldn't get there.
Yeah. Can I show you a few more pieces?
Sure, absolutely.
So this is not a designer piece. And this piece may be, it may be 50s or 60s. It might be what we call Victorian revival, which was just a way of saying, you know, we go through waves of time where things are popular. Original Victorian jewelry, obviously, was popular. And now maybe in the 50s and 60s, somebody discovered it again and came out with the same styles, but just modified a little bit. But I just think this is such a pretty little necklace. I would call it a drape necklace. It has a little diamond and it has a beautiful little swirls. This sort of overall shape, which is kind of like an upside down V, I think is very, very complimentary on most women because it balances the roundness of our heads and our faces.
What's the little fob on the bottom?
It's just a decoration. It's a dangle and it has, you know, they have, there's two smaller dangles attached to the larger piece of the necklace. And then there's this little piece that is dangling underneath.
Now, what makes you say that's the 50s and 60s? It certainly looks like 19th century jewelry.
It looks quite a bit older, but
yeah.
there's something about it that looks to me. I'm not ruling out that it couldn't be older, but there's something that looks to me like it was made more recently. I don't know if it's because it has very fine metalwork and it's all intact. Mm-hmm. The condition is immaculate. It could be. It was just a very fine older piece, but more likely it was something that was made later of those earlier styles.
I trust your trained eye, but it's a nice piece.
It's a nice piece.
It's a beautiful piece.
Yeah, and
I like the history.
You don't think about it now.
I would never, not even for a second. The jewelry is not my wheelhouse, and like I would walk, like, you know, I don't think I've ever looked at. I came in and looked at like what you were selling to hear like the stories of these things, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's what I find interesting too. Yeah.
Now this is actually a new piece, but this is 18 karat gold, and it was, you know, you have jewelry which is made, fabricated, it's die struck or it's casted. And you know, they make many, many pieces, and then you have handmade pieces. This is a handmade piece by a jeweler who lives in Sharon, Connecticut, and he's actually English and was trained in England and lived in Australia and in Kentucky, and now has made his home in Sharon. He does absolutely beautiful work. It's called the White Horse Collection. And I'm going to buckle this so you can just see the clasp is a little piece of jewelry in and of itself.
Now, what is the design on the clasp? I can't make it out.
The design is, it's really like a flower. It's a round flower.
Okay.
But, you know, when you look at a piece of jewelry and you're spending a lot of money, you want to look at it a couple of different ways. One of the other things you want to do is you want to look at the backside and see how finished it is. That tells you, you know, the quality of the piece. So, for example, you didn't see it, but I just turned that over in my hand. And the beautiful links that were on the front are decorated on the back. And it almost looks like you could wear it either way. It's so nicely made. Mm-hmm.
So, is that like a lock concept?
Well, it might look a little bit like that. I mean, okay. this piece of the clasp looks like a lock.
Yeah. From Zoom, it just looked like a lock.
But when you put it together, that's what it looks like. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah. If you're wearing this bracelet, and oftentimes what happens is the bracelet will spin around, you're not going to mind if you have a clasp like that the bracelet spins around. I mean, that's quality. That really is.
I'm just curious, 10, 14, 18.
That's 18 karat gold.
Yeah. What makes the difference in those carats?
Sure. Well, gold is, 24 karat gold is pure gold.
Okay.
And they add alloys to it to strengthen it. Mm-hmm. And so if you have 18 karat gold, and in Europe, oftentimes you'll see 750, it's 75% real gold and 25% alloy. 14 karat gold in Italy, for example, is 585. It's 58.5% pure gold and the rest is alloys. So, and the alloys, can make a difference. That's if you're talking about rose gold, you can have 14 karat rose gold. The way you get the rose color is they add copper as one of the alloys to the metal. White gold, I think they used to add nickel. I'm not sure, but they add, white metals to yellow gold to make 14 karat white gold. So
is 10 karat an outlier or?
10 carats, you see a lot of class rings that are 10 carat. There's a lot of jewelry that comes from England, I think, that's 9 carat. 10 carat was you see a lot of older jewelry that's 10 carat. The benefit to the something when you go lower in that that carat is that usually those other alloys that they add to the gold strengthen the piece. Gold is very soft. So, for example, I've seen a lot of watch chains that are quite old that are 10 karat gold. And, that's actually a good thing when you think about it, because watches were worn every day and they were taken in and out of pockets and they were,
pocket watches.
And, so they were pieces that were worn, or a class ring even. It's worn, somebody puts it on and they wear it their whole life. 10 karat gold is going to be a stronger metal than a 14 or an 18. So there's a practical reason for it as well.
Right. Okay. I appreciate that.
Sure. My pleasure.
Yeah. What else you got? I see some other cool pieces.
I have actually just one more that I wanted to show
that
you.
Oh, one, yeah.
This is an Edwardian piece. And this has very beautiful metal work with little tiny diamond accents.
Edwardian was the guy before Victoria.
No,
Edwardian. The guy after him.
Exactly.
Told you.
And
I knew it.
You can't necessarily see it on the monitor, but these blue sapphires actually have a little more green in them. So you can see that.
Yeah, they look almost black.
Yeah, they look a little.
I'll say this. I knew that they were sapphires from the other ones, so I've learned something today.
Good. Now, the only thing with this piece is they've added this chain on the back. And the chain is white gold, and it certainly does what it's supposed to do in terms of being able to wear this. I'm thinking that this was actually something else. This could have been on a cord worn around somebody's neck. It could have been something else, but it has now been modified into a bracelet. Mm-hmm. But it's just that little bit of workmanship is just really, really beautiful.
So would you say the 19 teens maybe?
Yeah, or? I would say. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Round World War One era.
Yeah, round World War One. Yep. Yeah.
Well, that's very nice. I appreciate you showing us this stuff.
Well, thank you.
And as Shawnee Boy said, I actually learned an incredible amount. So somebody that goes to jeheatonjewelers.com, as I said before, they should be able to see your entire inventory.
Yeah, they should. Yep. And if they want to see more silver items, I'm afraid they're going to have to come into the store. But it's
don't be afraid.
It's a lovely little store.
So we welcome you.
Yeah.
And it's not little.
No, it's two floors.
And a back.
Yeah, and a garden.
Right. We have croquet escalators, meaning you got to walk up the stairs.
Yeah, that's okay. We'll exercise while you shop.
That's right.
But that's right. So Joyce is, as you come into the store, she's on this, I think, the second booth on the left.
Yes. Yep, I am. I am there. And I do go back and forth to Maine a little bit, but generally I'm there in person on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays.
But you're online 24/7.
I'm online 24/7. And
she's working hard, Sean.
And it's needed. Starting in November, I'm probably going to work, 5 days a week through the holiday season. So my hours are flexible. I also agree to meet people if they want me to come and meet them. I'm glad to do that.
And we certainly hope some people that are local, relatively local, in the tri-state area, say, come in to visit you in person and to be able to look at these in person, which is, they are quite astounding in person.
Thank you, yeah.
But someone from, Des Moines or wherever they go on.
Albuquerque.
Someone not from the tri-state area.
Is a real world outside of the tri-state area, and we do understand.
I heard about that, but you got to pay a toll, so you might as well.
That's not real. That's not real.
But is somebody that does go on jeheatonjewelers.com, which there will be a link to the site on both the audio version of this and the video version of this. What's the process for them? They want, say, that Edwardian bracelet we just saw, they want that. What happens from the time they contact you?
Well, what happens is they go online, they see the picture and the description, and they purchase it right online.
Okay.
And then
do they generally contact you prior to purchase?
They don't need to. If they have questions, they're certainly welcome to.
Okay. What happens generally? Do they?
They would just purchase it, and then I would send it to them.
Okay.
But for example, over the weekend,
do you usually have interaction with customers, potential customers online prior to them actually making a purchase?
Well, I have an ability on my website for anybody to send me a message. Mm-hmm. And I got one of those over the weekend about a diamond solitaire ring on the website. So I have I'm in communication with this customer about this diamond ring. So I think that customer service is really, really, really important.
Well, it's the primary important.
It really is. And people have to A, trust me, and they have to B, understand that I'm going to do whatever needs to be done to
trust her, Sean?
Make them happy.
Oh, come on. Of course.
Well, and hit the buy button.
Today? Uh-huh. What'd you say?
Hit the buy button.
Yeah.
So, as I said at the onset of this podcast, she's well known locally and not so locally. People do come from all over the place to visit you and trusted by, she's, as she said, customer service is her number one priority, really. She cares more about interacting with the customer than she does really about selling the thing.
Well, and actually also, Tom, sometimes I'll tell people things that don't involve them using me for whatever it is they want. But my goal is for people to be happy. And if they're happy, maybe they won't buy through me this time, but they might down the road another time. And, why not help people? I mean, and why not educate them? I think that those are really important things.
Well, I have the advantage of witnessing her interaction with customers when they come into the store and look at jewelry. And if I can impart that to people who are looking on her website, she does care about what she's selling. And, you know, she cares about the people she's selling to. So I don't want to say it's rare, but it's certainly not common.
Well, thank you, Tom. I thought all that time you were over there sleeping.
No, usually I'm observing. Observing.
Okay.
It sounds more like he's paying attention to what you're doing and not paying attention to what he needs to be doing.
All right. Well, I certainly thank you for your time today,
thank
Joyce.
You. And, I really enjoyed it. Thank you, Sean. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
.com is where Sean's going to go to buy that Victorian thing.
Okay.
Oh, 100%.
And like I said, the links for her site will be on the audio and video portion of this thing.
Just so you know, every item she held up, there was a price tag, and I just was like, what? I saw the number on the each item, so I'm like, nope.
Sean, there's a price for happiness.
Yes. Well, you know what?
Very true.
Non-negotiable is the two words I throw at you right now.
Gotcha.
No, but thank you, Joyce, for coming
thank
by.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Shawnee boy,
thank
we'll
you
see you later in the week, lad.
All right, sounds good.
All right.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye.